This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehius Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There was no kidnap. There was no any wrongdoing in the process of his getting here. He got here on the basis of what he believed and wanted to do.
It was Rwandan President Paul Kagame on allegations that his government illegally snatched the subject of a 2004 Oscar-nominated film, Hotel Rwanda, for allegedly funding rebel groups. Details coming up also. U.S. lawmakers are focusing on what they say is an erosion of democratic institutions in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And inspirational young people from Burundi, Malawi, Nigeria, and Tanzania are designing solutions to help their communities confront COVID-19. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. First, we start with our top story. U.S. lawmakers convened a hearing yesterday in Washington focusing on what they say is an erosion of democratic institutions in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa and its impact in the region's economic growth as well as access to health and education resources. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has the story.
Several countries in sub-Saharan Africa are retreating from core democratic principles, says U.S. Representative Karen Bass, chair of the House Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, Global Human Rights, and International Organizations.
Democratic backsliding includes, but is not limited to, the degradation of free and fair elections, infringement on freedom of speech, impairment of political opposition to challenge the government or hold it accountable, the weakening of the rule of law.
During Wednesday's hearing, Bass said flawed elections remain an issue in most of Africa, with leaders manipulating laws, freedoms, and elections to retain power.
Most concerning is the situation in Tanzania, which I recently addressed in House Resolution 1120, where current leadership is repressing the opposition and basic freedoms of expression and assembly in a blatant attempt to retain power. We see similar patterns in Cote d'Ivoire as the executive branch legalizes the deviation in democratic institutions to codify non-democratic actions.
Cote d'Ivoire has seen recent violence that left at least a dozen people dead since last month after 78-year-old incumbent President Alassane Ouattara broke a promise made earlier this year not to seek re-election. Ouattara reversed his stance and accepted the nomination of his ruling party after his hand-picked successor died suddenly of a heart attack in July. Experts testifying on Capitol Hill noted a backward trend. Christopher Fomunyo from the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs told U.S. lawmakers that Africa went from having only two countries classified as free in 1989 to two-thirds of the countries classified as either free or partially free 20 years later. But now, he says, those democratic gains have been reversed.
Notably, West Africa, previously commended as a trailblazer region, has seen serious backsliding as Mali experienced a military coup and major controversies have arisen about candidacies of incumbent presidents in Guinea-Conakry and Cote d'Ivoire. The Central Africa region remains stuck with the highest concentration of autocratic regimes with the three longest-serving presidents in the world.
Fomunyo listed some of the longest-serving leaders in Equatorial Guinea, 41 years, in Cameroon, 58 years, and Congo-Brazzaville, nearly four decades in power. Freedom and democratic governance is enjoyed by far too few Africans, with only 9% of people in sub-Saharan Africa living in countries that Freedom House categorizes as free, said John Temin, the Africa Program Director at Freedom House. The organization's most recent report on freedom in the world notes that of the 12 countries with the largest decline, 7 are in sub-Saharan Africa.
Citizens bear the brunt of democratic backsliding. They are attacked when they peacefully protest in opposition to the government, as in Guinea and Cameroon. They are unable to use the internet when the government restricts access, as in Ethiopia and Chad. Civil society groups face excessive limitations on their activity, as in Tanzania and Burundi. And journalists are threatened and detained, as in Nigeria and Zimbabwe.
When it comes to elections, there are some encouraging signs, remarked another witness, Dorina Becker from the Institute for Defense Analysis.
Kenyan civil society has pioneered electronic platforms where citizens can record incidents of fraud and harassment, and that's been replicated many places on the continent. There are election situation rooms where information is conveyed to a central location, and steps are taken to mitigate tension. Parallel vote tabulation is also widely practiced as a check on official results.
She also noted other positive trends taking place, including in Ghana, Senegal, Botswana, Mauritius, and South Africa. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
The story of how Paul Rusesabagina protected Hutu and Tutsi refugees during the Rwandan genocide was the subject of a 2004 Oscar-nominated film, Hotel Rwanda. But Rusesabagina was arrested last month in Rwanda, accused of funding rebel groups. Observers tell VOA they fear his conviction in a Kigali court is a foregone conclusion. VOA's Salem Solomon has the latest.
Paul Rusesabagina is the hero in the Oscar-nominated film Hotel Rwanda, which told the story of his efforts to save Hutu and Tutsi refugees during the 1994 Rwanda genocide. But today, he's awaiting trial in Kigali, charged with sponsoring rebel groups and terrorism-related offenses. Civil rights groups and those who know him say the circumstances of his arrest and detention are questionable. Rusesabagina says he was invited by a friend to speak in Burundi, but when he boarded a private jet in Dubai, he was instead flown to Kigali and arrested. Brian Endless is a professor at Loyola University and has worked with Rusesabagina.
Having known Paul for almost 15 years, there's not the slightest chance he would have gone to Rwanda voluntarily because he knew something exactly like this would happen to him if he went to Rwanda voluntarily.
Endless believes the process was illegal.
This was clearly illegal, whether you want to call it extraordinary rendition, kidnapping, illegal abduction. When a person gets on a plane and it is under a false pretense with the intention of bringing them somewhere to arrest them, that is internationally an illegal process to bring that person to the country.
But Rwandan President Paul Kagame defends Rusesabagina's detention.
There was no kidnap, there was no any wrongdoing in the process of his getting here. He got here on the basis of what he believed and wanted to do.
Critics say the arrest stems from Rusesabagina's opposition to President Kagame. The government maintains it is because of his work with the Rwanda Movement for Democratic Change, an opposition party that he co-founded and which has been linked to acts of violence and terrorism. Rusesabagina doesn't deny crimes were committed, but insists he was not involved and that he is only interested in diplomacy. Critics also say so far, Rusesabagina has not been allowed to choose his own lawyer and has been denied bail. And legal experts say they want to monitor the trial.
One of the main reasons that we monitor trials is to shine a light, to remind governments of their obligations to respect fundamental, you know, rights, including the right to choose a lawyer of one's choice, as well as numerous other rights.
That was Muya Nyaundi, an attorney with American Bar Association's Center for Human Rights. The center plans to monitor an upcoming trial as part of the Clooney Foundation for Justice Trial Watch Initiative. They said that Rwanda is party to the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights and the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, in which guarantee the accused a fair trial, a lawyer of his choosing, and the presumption of innocence. Stephen Townley is a senior program manager at Trial Watch.
There are very concerning trends, some of them exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, in terms of the instrumentalization of courts against the vulnerable or those who criticize the government. But the hope is that trial monitoring, whether in the moment or by virtue of the record that it creates, can induce governments to abide by their international obligations.
While there are troubling questions about Rusesabagina's detention, he may still get a fair trial, according to international politics professor Phil Clark.
There is often a misconception about the Rwandan judiciary that it is simply the lapdog of Kagame's executive. And I think what we've seen in the last 10 years is something very different happen. We've actually seen a very independent judiciary begin to rise up in Rwanda, often handing down judgments contrary to the wishes of the national executive.
But Endless and other Rusesabagina supporters disagree and remain very concerned about his fate in a Rwandan courtroom. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
The director of epidemiology at the Moroccan Health Ministry, Mohamed Layobi, expects his country's COVID-19 situation to worsen over winter as the pandemic overlaps with flu season. Morocco has closed air and sea borders for months, and people are barred from entering or leaving 8 cities to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Still, the kingdom has registered more than 110,000 positive cases since March and has a death toll of 2,041, the highest among its North African neighbors. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Elizabeth Myers, an American analyst living in Morocco and the founding editor of Inside Arabia, about the reasons behind that spike.
I think there are a number of factors. I would say that the measures were initially very drastic, but they have decreased over time, including the closing of the cities. Not only the cities, but the borders were closed. There were strict authorizations that were required. In other words, if you wanted to travel, for example, from Marrakesh, where I am, to Casablanca, which is about a 2-hour drive on the motorway, you would have to actually get a physical authorization to go for a specific reason. That really curtailed travel a huge amount. Over time, the restrictions have gotten a little bit more lackadaisical. And frankly, there came a point really in June and July that I really got a sense that the people manning these checkpoints, the whether they were police or the gendarmes, which is essentially the national police, were kind of getting tired with this procedure and checking people. And since then, I've seen a lot more laxness, shall we say, in the comings and goings from the cities. Although there have been specific times where specific cities were closed and they reimposed the travel restrictions as the COVID cases surged in those particular cities. And I would say also that one of the other factors in the spread of the virus is the lack of discipline of the people. But one of the failings, unfortunately, I think, of the government was a lack of communication about the seriousness of the situation. And what they tend to do here is, rather than explain a problem or educate the public on a problem or have a major public awareness campaign, as I urged early on should be done on multiple media sources, whether radio, TV, social media, that really wasn't done. And so there are not only a number of people who don't believe that there's a COVID crisis, there are people who just are so sick and tired and just thinking that things are getting back to normal that they simply don't take the precautions that are still being urged and still actually part of the law here in Morocco. And so it's been a very difficult thing for Morocco.
So with the rise in cases, how ready are the hospitals and the intensive care units in Morocco to face the new challenge?
Initially, the preparation for an expectation of cases rising and surging was incredible. The preparations by building field hospitals, by staffing up hospitals, by focusing on the necessary protective equipment that was needed in the hospitals was fantastic. And the ramping up of actually producing masks for the entire population in Morocco was an incredible feat that was done extremely quickly in a matter of weeks. Now we're in a situation where there are hospitals in which there's simply not enough staff, not enough nurses and doctors to take care of the people who are needing care. We've seen situations where there have been just patients in the hospitals are bringing the air cylinders, the oxygen cylinders to other patients, as opposed to orderlies or nurses doing that work. And in some of the private hospitals, there is a big lack of both latex gloves, which are not made locally in Morocco, and also surgical masks, which were not part of the ramp up in production. The masks that started to be produced here were really more for the public to prevent the transmission amongst the people through just proximity. But proper surgical masks akin to the N95s that we talk about in the US, there is a shortage in the private hospitals.
The director of epidemiology at the Moroccan Health Ministry, Mohamed Layoubi, expects the situation to worsen over winter as the flu season overlaps with the COVID-19 pandemic. How serious is such a concern if the tough measures manage to turn the infection curve down?
The government really, really needs to step up, start making some decisions. There needs to be a focus on doing that and figuring out some kind of planning ahead, because right now it seems that we're dealing with a day-to-day kind of reaction. Every government announcement is at the last minute. The announcements come at the last minute. You cannot prepare, you cannot plan, and I hope that we can manage to get through the flu season and the next waves, and there's not an end in sight.
That was Elizabeth Myers, the founding editor of Inside Arabia, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. As of today, South Africa is allowing restricted international travel as part of its efforts to loosen COVID-19 rules and kickstart the battered economy. Leisure travelers from high-risk countries will still not be permitted to enter. Reporter Vicky Stark in Cape Town has more on the requirements.
Only three South African airports will be open for international travelers: OR Tambo in Johannesburg, King Shaka in Durban, and Cape Town International. Minister of International Relations Naledi Pandor says all those arriving will need to produce results of a COVID test.
Scientifically, they say it's polymerase chain reaction test, not older than 72 hours from the time of departure from your country of origin to South Africa. The test must be conducted by a certified medical practitioner, and the certificate you produce at point of entry must have the name and signature of the practitioner who conducted the test.
Pando says even those with a certificate will also be screened on arrival. They will have their temperatures taken and asked a series of questions. She says it may also be necessary for another test to be done.
We are requiring, because the tests cost money, that every person traveling into South Africa must have travel insurance in order to cover the cost of the test. And should the test be positive, the cost of quarantine. So mandatory travel insurance for those reasons, so that South Africa doesn't find itself overburdened with test costs.
She says leisure travelers from high-risk countries where COVID-19 infections and death rates remain high will not be permitted into South Africa. The lengthy list includes the United Kingdom, the United States, and France.
Only persons who are high skills visa holders, who are investors in the economy of South Africa, will be allowed entry if they are from a high-risk country, or diplomats, as is currently the regulatory position. Leisure travelers will be permitted from medium-risk and low-risk countries. We will also allow travelers from the African continent, both for business and leisure purposes.
Pando says the 35 land border posts, which were closed due to COVID-19, will remain shut for now. She's urged all travelers entering the country to download the official COVID Alert app, which makes contact tracing easier. Pando also says the lists of high, medium, and low-risk countries will be reviewed every 2 weeks. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
Farmers in northern Nigeria have lost more than 2 million tons of rice, a quarter of the country's projected harvest, due to flooding. Despite the loss, Nigeria is so far upholding a year-long ban on land-based imports of rice to crack down on smuggling and boost local production. Ifeoke Tang reports from Argungu, Nigeria.
Ibrahim Abdullahi is looking at what remains of his 350-hectare rice farm in Nigeria's Kebbi State. Abdullahi was expecting to harvest 300 tons of rice, but weeks of severe flooding means he'll be lucky to get 100.
Since when I started farming, I have not experienced intensive cultivation of rice as now, because a lot of people are into the rice farming. But unfortunately, we experience this intensive flooding that we are experiencing now. And farmers are now counting losses, because 90% of our farmers, they have lost what they have cultivated.
Nigeria's biggest rice-producing state, Kebbi, had projected 2.5 million tons this year. But heavy September rains washed away 2 million tons. Local rice miller Mohammed Anauna says this could cause a further jump in the price of the grain.
If rain have already washed away all the farm product, you know the goose will be rising up. Because a little one that they have on the ground, they will make sure that they recover the one that the water moves away. So that they will double the price.
With Africa's largest population, Nigeria annually imports billions of dollars of rice and wheat, but hopes to become self-sufficient. Last year, the government banned land-based rice imports to crack down on smuggling and boost local rice production. Despite the lost rice, the Nigerian officials say the ban will remain in place. Chairman of the All Farmers Association in Nigeria, John Weeb, says affected farmers will be compensated.
The government and even the financial institutions have put a machinery in force. So many who have lost now are already preparing for the dry season farming.
Nigeria's Farmers Association say better groundwork is needed to capture rains so that it can prevent flooding and have a steady water supply during the dry season. Flood reduction will also help save homes and the displacement of thousands of Nigerians from overflowing rivers. Ifeoke Etang for VOA News, Argungu, Nigeria.
The long-term impact of COVID-19 will hit adolescent girls particularly hard, with many unlikely to return to school due to pregnancies, early marriages, and economic hardships, according to an international agency. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has more from Harare.
Rachel Goba is the Plan International Zimbabwe Sexual Reproductive Health and Rights Team Leader. She explains their recent research.
Plan International Zimbabwe conducted a rapid gender assessment survey, and this was also in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. It was a quick survey, as we were just trying to get a snapshot of what is currently occurring with regards to adolescents and young people, particularly looking at adolescent girls and young women.
She says the findings raised serious concerns.
One of the biggest observations, which is very worrisome to us as Plan International Zimbabwe, is that adolescent girls have been engaging in sex, and not just sex, but also unprotected sex. Girls are affected more than boys, the main reason being because of the vulnerability that comes with being a girl.
Goba says COVID-19's impact on food insecurity has left many girls vulnerable to sexual exploitation, and she doesn't foresee a decrease in unsafe sex.
The lockdown is gradually relaxing and schools are reopening. We can't say the trend of indulging in safe sex is actually likely to decrease. What is more worrisome is girls might fail to actually go back to school when schools open. The vulnerabilities will not go away.
Gova calls for society to fight for the girls to be able to continue their education as they deal with pregnancies, early marriages, and economic hardships. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.